Some notes on medical practices. Most of the little information I have concerning Kesh medicine was given me in conversation by Alder of the Serpentine and the Doctor's Lodge of Chumo and of Sinshan. He said that a doctor did four things: prevent, care, cure, and kill. Preventive medicine included immunization, public and personal hygiene, teaching and advice about diet, work habits, workplaces, and exercise, counseling for a psychic strain and distress, and a wide variety of kinds of massage, manipulation, music, and dance. Body work, in our terms. Care, or alleviation, involved treatment of fevers, aches, infections, and communicable diseases, and the care of people suffering from handicaps and incurable disorders. Curative practices included bone setting, the use of a large and complex pharmacopoeia, therapeutic bodywork, and surgery. I do not have a list of surgical operations the Kesh considered feasible. Alder at one time or another mentioned having performed amputation, curettage, appendectomy, removal of an abdominal tumor, removal of skin cancers, and an operation to close a cleft palate. Anesthesia for a major operation was induced by herbal drugs taken for a period of days before and after surgery, and by the lances, a system of thin bamboo needles inserted according to a body chart, which, to this ignorant eye, looked a good deal like an acupuncture chart. I did not hear about anything like therapeutic acupuncture. As our medicine makes no place for killing, considering itself in binary opposition to death, we have only the slightly suspect euthanasia to name practices the Kesh considered part of any doctor's work and a serious element of medical theory and morality. Castration of animals, human abortion, which was considered neither a minor nor a reprehensible operation, and the killing of monstrous births, both human and animal. There was no distinction by caste of the veterinary from the doctor, though physicians usually specialized to some extent, according to their knack and the community's need. There seemed to be no dentists as such, probably because most Kesh had good teeth and ate a low-sugar diet. Gedwean, bringing in. This most characteristic of Kesh medical practices could be called a healing ceremony if it's understood that a coronary bypass operation could also be called a healing ceremony. Current high-technology medical practice in well-equipped hospitals includes the latter. Valley medicine included the former. Both are cases of a specialized technology used by trained professionals, reflecting a certain moral stance and embodying certain judgments on the means and ends of medicine. Statistics comparing rates of alleviation, short-term cure, long-term cure, and failure would be interesting, but inappropriate. Since each bringing in was created for an individual in particular circumstances of illness or stress by a particular doctor or group of doctors, I can't give a general description, and a description of an actual bringing in would violate Kesh standards of personal and sacred discretion. In the abstract, then, a bringing in involved two parties, the Godwe, or brought, and the Dwesh, or bringers. The Godwe, usually one person but sometimes a married couple or a child with a parent or sibling, lived for the 4, 5, or 9-day period of the Gedwean in their heimas or in the doctor's lodge building. They were looked after attentively, given a special diet or fasting pattern, and followed a carefully prescribed regime of activity and rest. Their body and face were marked or painted, and they wore special clothing, a long, loosely belted shift of wool chally. Such a garment was the gift of a weaver to the doctor's lodge in exchange, payment or prepayment, for medical attention. Contrary to the theory and practice of shamanistic and psychiatric curing, where the cost is an essential ingredient of the cure, Kesh doctors charged nothing. Their practice was an integral part of the continuous exchange of services and goods that formed the Kesh village economy. The cost of successful practice to the doctor may be glimpsed in what Stone Telling mentions of Alder's patients in Chumo and Sinshan. The dwesh, or bringers, one of whom had to be a singing doctor, worked out the treatment ceremony, which might include drug therapy, use of trance-inducing drugs, hypnosis through drumming and singing, massage, bathing, exercises, the teaching of symbols and figures drawn in sifted dust or painted or marked on the skin, and the discussion of the meaning of such symbols, and also of songs, stories, and events in the life of the person being brought in. The performance of rituals, some of them traditional and some the private property of the doctor, obtained in vision or from another doctor as a gift. And the invention and performance of songs, dances, and drum patterns by patient and doctor together. The Godway left the bringing in with recommendations for further treatment, if necessary, and a routine to follow to maintain the healing effects of the Gedweon itself. Alder told me that he believed the beneficial effect of a bringing in lay to a great extent in attention, the attention paid to the Godway, who was the center of everybody's interest in a supportive, comforting, unstressed environment of warmth, rest, soft drumming and singing, and the attention which the Godway must pay to his or her life and thinking and the mystical or intellectual or practical insights arrived at by the combined work of the people involved in the bringing in. It was a pretty good example of what the Kesh meant by Avron, carefulness, taking care. Some people were brought in many times in a lifetime, others once or never. Some members of the doctor's lodge would act as dwesh on request, others only in cases they considered serious. And though the former were liked for their response to a need for sympathy, it was the latter who were most respected. All doctors who performed bringings in also had been Godway, and were brought in from time to time as training and as therapy. Dying. Fatally ill people, most of them sufferers from sevai, vedet, or cancer, came to live at the doctor's lodge in a hospice routine called huagedwean, continuous bringing in. The alleviation of misery was set ahead of the prolongation of life as a rule. If a patient asked for death and the family and close friends agreed, the issue was discussed by the lodge. If the judgment was that death was appropriate, four doctors undertook to be present. Euthanasia was performed as a ceremony, ritually, as were abortion and the killing of a monstrously defective birth. Euthanasia was performed with poison, given orally or injected. Abortion was performed by curettage, preceded and followed by treatment with herbals. Monstrous births, if they did not die of their infirmities at once, were starved, being looked after but not fed, until they died. In response to my questions on this latter subject, Alder gave me this written statement. People, human and animal, that we kill or let die when they are born, are those with two heads or joined bodies, those born du-sevai, a baby born with advanced sevai, blind, deaf, and subject to muscle spasm which prevented it from suckling, and those born very terribly misshapen or without brain, without skin, or without another organ necessary to life. Such people, born dying, are let die. Human people, born who cannot live, are let die with care and singing the songs of going westward with them, and the mother names them so they can be mourned at the mourning fires of the equinox. Animal people of the obsidian house, born unable to live, are killed in the proper way with the due words, and the death is burned. Birthing. This seemed to be the only area where doctors specialized by sex. In animal practice, there were almost as many men expert in attending on a difficult cow or ewe birth as there were women, but men doctors seldom presided at a human birth, and some women doctors, itatensho, or senders, specialized pretty exclusively in the care of pregnant and nursing women and as midwives. The complex and beautiful ceremonies of pregnancy and birth were directed by women of the Blood Lodge, who were or who worked with women of the Doctor's Lodge. Prenatal care and education was thorough, mostly embodied in ritual and ceremony. At the time of birth, hygiene was extremely strict. If the household of the mother failed to set aside a room for the birth and to have it ready and clean, down to scrubbed, sanded wood, fresh paint, boiled linens, and all the rest of a set of most exacting standards, the lodge might insist that the delivery take place in their own building. The mother stayed in this clean, quiet, dimly lit room with the baby for a formal 9-day rest period. Friends and family might come in to visit and sing, a few at a time. The father was in charge of welcoming, filtering, and sending away the visitors. A man of the father's house could act in his stead if the father was absent or divorced or otherwise not given responsibility for the child. He or his stand-in was expected to help the new mother with her work and keep her from overdoing while she was nursing the baby, though in fact her household normally protected or overprotected a young mother until she had to insist upon her freedom to come and go and work as she pleased. Thorne, who was in training as an itatensho with the doctors of Tsinshan, said that difficult labor and delivery were unusual, but that many pregnancies ended in unavoidable premature or stillbirth, or in severely defective birth, due evidently to genetic damage. The same was true of the large animals, less so of the smaller animals, who in their more rapid generations had discarded the worst injuries resulting from old environmental poisoning and other traumas affecting the gene pool of every species. Diseases. This list of illnesses is imprecise, incomplete, and probably wrong in many places. I could not identify many of the conditions which Alder tried to describe to me, and we were never perfectly sure we were talking about the same thing. Viral and bacterial mutations will have occurred, changing the nature of many diseases, no doubt, but the main problem was one of vocabulary. Keshe's theory of medicine and methods of diagnosis differed profoundly from ours. For example, though clearly aware of the role played by bacteria and viruses, the latter of which were utterly invisible to their microscopes, as agents of disease, they did not identify disease or a disease as an entity in itself. It was not something that happened to a person, but something a person did. The closest I could come to translating our word health into Keshe would be the word oya, ease or grace, or the word gestanai, living well, doing well, with a combination of inborn talent, luck, and skill. To translate our word disease or illness, I would have to use the primitive forms poya, unease, not so far from the original sense of dis-ease, or difficulty or hardness, and gepestanai, living ill, doing badly, unlucky, unskillful. These Keshe words imply that the sick person is not a patient, but an agent, not merely suffering an invasion from outside the body, but doing or being illness. Curiously enough, I think this view of illness involves less sense of guilt than does our image of a body victimized by malevolent forces from without. Implicit in it is an acceptance that we don't always do what we would like, or hope, or ought to do, and that living is not always easy. The practices of the doctor's lodge were not in the service of an ideal of perfect health, permanent youth, and the eradication of disease. They tried only to ensure that living wasn't any harder than it had to be. There were doctor's lodge ceremonies for immunization of infants at 9, 54, and 81 days old, of children at 2, 4, 5, and 9 years old, and of adults at request or need. Diseases which the Keshe doctors could prevent or mitigate by inoculation or immunization are mentioned in the following list. Tetanus, rabies, malaria, bubonic plague are the four diseases I feel I could identify with certainty. Immunization existed for all these, and was given to infants and children, and to adults at need. Malaria was the scourge of the great inland marshes and estuaries, and though the immunization was fairly effective, it was not so completely so that the Keshe were very happy about traveling in the Great Valley marshlands. But then they were mostly not very happy about traveling anywhere. Plague was still carried by ground squirrels, which were therefore never hunted and never handled. But no outbreak of plague had occurred in or near the Valley of the Na in living memory. My inquiries for the symptoms of smallpox and tuberculosis left Alder unable to identify these diseases as such. We did seem to be talking about the same thing when I brought up the diseases or conditions of which the herpes virus is the agent: chickenpox, cold sore, genital herpes, shingles. Alder knew them all and considered them to be related, grouping them under the name Chimhem. Chickenpox was as serious in children as in adults, and immunization was mandatory and effective. Venereal diseases, presumably varieties of syphilis and gonorrhea, were mostly called fuck sores or foreigner's misery, the latter being fair enough, since none was endemic in the valley. Another reason for not traveling. Alder knew several treatments, but no methods of prevention, except hygiene. The rest of the diseases mentioned are identified only uncertainly. Infants were immunized against something that sounded like diphtheria, and against a rash which was certainly not measles, but might have been a form of scarlet fever. What Alder called wet lung was certainly some form of pneumonia. Penicillin, or a fungal derivative like it, was effective in treatment. I did not try to understand the immensely complex pharmacopoeia, mostly derived from herbs. Infectious hepatitis and some form of infectious jaundice were fairly common. Alder said that liver disorders were among the least tractable common illnesses. Hygiene was the principal tactic used against them. Passionately careful about their use of water and the condition of their streams and wells, the Kesh knew of typhoid only through books and the exchange. Cancers of the skin were quite common. Other forms of cancer certainly occurred, but seemed to have been less common than among us. But here the differing approach and understanding may have led me quite astray. Heart diseases, treated with drugs and with Gedweon, if not symptomatic of congenital heart defect, seem to have been considered a liability of old age. The diseases or conditions which burdened the Kesh and their neighboring peoples with a load we don't have to carry were Sevai and Vedet, congenital, intractable, degenerative disorders of the nervous system. Forms of both diseases were shared with humanity by all the large domestic animals, and it was said that elk had died out in the whole inland sea drainage basin long ago because they were Vedet. As well as I could establish, both diseases expressed genetic, chromosomal damage caused by long-lasting toxic or radioactive wastes or residues of the military-industrial era, widespread in soil and water, and leaching out uncontrollably from the very highly contaminated areas. Vedet involved personality disorder and dementia. Sevai usually led to blindness and other sensory loss and degeneration of muscle control. Both diseases were painful, crippling, incurable, and fatal. Severity of onset and the length of the course of the illness depended very much on what Alder called the thoroughness of the condition. Major damage led to non-viability in the womb. Minor damage might not show up till late in life. Late in life in the valley would be over 60. Life expectancy in our terms, averaged over the whole lifespan, would be short, not over 30 or 40, because so many children were born Sevai or with other severe genetic abnormalities, leading to a high mortality in early infancy. But to a Kesh born Oya and living Gestanai, life generally went on well into the 70s, and old age was taken easily and lived very often with considerable skill and grace.